This is Marginalia, a production of KMUW Wichita.
Marginalia. Notes in the margin of a book.
Notes, commentary, and similar material written in the margin of a book.
Comments and notes which are incidental
or additional to
the main topic in the margin of a book.
Maggie Shipstad's novel, Great Circle, tells the story of two women who lived nearly a century apart, a daredevil aviator and a recently shamed Hollywood actor. Marion Graves longs to become the first pilot to circumnavigate the Great Circle over the North and South Poles, while Hadley Baxter attempts to understand Graves and herself in order to play the pilot on the big screen. I recently spoke with Maggie Shipstad about Great Circle and the force behind it. I'm Beth Golay, this is Marginalia, and here's our conversation. You describe this in the book, but I wonder if you can do so for our listeners. What is a Great Circle?
So a great circle is the circumference of a sphere at its widest point. So if you're talking about the globe, the equator is a great circle, and then every line of longitude is also a great circle. And so the reason like passenger jets will take a route, say, over the North Pole, which isn't necessarily intuitive as it's following the arc of a great circle, is the shortest distance between two points on a sphere.
That is very interesting. And now that describes the title, but to ask you to describe the novel seems a little bit unfair because it's so rich with characters and plots and subplots. But is it safe to say that the story revolves around one in particular, and that's Marion Graves?
Yeah, I think so. I can describe, I have a very short description.
Perfect.
I sort of have like a 4-second description or like a 4-minute one. So yeah, Great Circle is about a female pilot named Marion Graves who disappears in 1950 while trying to fly around the world north-south. And it's also about her life up to then, which is growing up in Missoula, Montana in the 20s, flying for a bootlegger, flying in Alaska in the 30s, flying during World War II in the UK. And it's also about a modern movie star named Hadley Baxter, who's playing Marion in a movie about her life and gets drawn into the mystery of her disappearance.
So when I was looking at your website, I saw a lot of your work as a travel writer. And then I thought, incorrectly, it turns out, that the opening line, "I was designed to be a wanderer," might have come straight from you. But then I read an interview that you gave to BookPage and I learned the real source of the line. Can you share that with us?
Sure. Yeah. The seed of this book was planted way back in 2012, and a project I was working on kind of had died on me, and I was traveling by myself in New Zealand, and I was at the airport, and the international terminal is named after a pilot named Gene Batten, who was the first person to fly solo from London to New Zealand in the 30s, and it's a beautiful statue of her, and then there's a plaque engraved with a quote from her, which is, "I was destined to be a wanderer." And that sort of morphed into the first line of the book, which is, "I was born to be a wanderer." So that was just always kind of in the back of my head and really the sort of heart of Marion's character.
You know, another female pilot you mentioned a few times in the book has a Kansas connection, and we are based in Wichita, Kansas, and that is Amelia Earhart.
Sure.
In your research about female pilots, you know, and you had to do some extensive research, what surprised you the most?
Well, one thing that I think is very interesting is Amelia Earhart is, of course, the female pilot we all think of first now, you know, and probably the only one where kids will dress up as Amelia Earhart still for Halloween or for, doing famous people at school. But really in sort of the era of early-ish flight, like in the 20s and 30s, there are quite a few really famous female pilots who are household names and front page news. One who's mentioned in the book is Eleanor Smith, who is sort of a really naturally gifted pilot. And as a teenager, she broke all kinds of records. And I think Beryl Markham's still remembered, but just that it used to be big news. If you did anything sort of new in an airplane or broke a speed record across the country, people would know who you were. And a lot of women were famous for it.
But then there was something in the book also where, was it even Amelia Earhart who, you know, she was allowed to fly across the Atlantic, but not to take off or land? Is that right?
That was Jacqueline Cochran.
Okay, I'm sorry. Yeah. I had the wrong name.
Amelia Earhart, when she first became famous, it was for being the first woman to fly across the Atlantic, but she was literally a passenger.
Right. Okay, that's it.
And that really bothered her. I think that really motivated her to become a better pilot and to do some significant first flights herself. But yeah, Jackie Cochran established a core of female pilots, helped an existing one in the UK and then established a domestic one in the US during World War II, where female pilots transported warplanes, so from factories to airfields or between repair depots. She was a very accomplished pilot, and she was kind of trying to prove what a contribution women could make. And so she wanted to do a transatlantic flight, and she was allowed to. She just wasn't allowed to take off or land, just sort of arbitrarily, as you mentioned.
You know, I mentioned, you know, a lot of the research that went into this book, because, you know, ships and art and war, and you mentioned bootlegging and Hollywood and Alaska and Hawaii and all of the locations and flying. You know, in that same book page interview, you said you took control of a plane for 30 seconds. Is that right?
I was given control, just to be clear.
Oh, yeah, I should rephrase that.
But I went for a glider flight in New Zealand, and the pilot was sitting behind me, and he said, you know, well, do you want to make a turn? And I've never felt the urge to fly. My brother is just leaving the Air Force after 20 years, and he doesn't fly anymore, but he used to be a pilot and was kind of one of those children who had to fly. And so it was never my thing, it was his thing. So anyway, I was in this glider and I said, sure. And I just found it felt quite precarious to me, and I don't have great spatial relations. So I think all my instincts, if I were to try to become a pilot, would be incorrect. So I was glad I had that little tiny experience, but it's not for me. Although I have enjoyed on different occasions getting to ride and in the front of an airplane and to just see that forward view as opposed to the sort of sideways view we're used to on commercial flights is, I think, really exciting and something I really learned a lot from, just seeing that vantage point.
I learned a lot from even just you describing flying by the seat of your pants. I never made that correlation before.
Yeah, I know. It's one of those phrases.
Yeah. You know, so from this research that I keep pounding on, your attention to detail was remarkable. Like when you were describing Jamie's painting, you included like color selection from his palette. So this question might be more about the editing process. It's my understanding that the original draft was quite a bit longer than these 600 pages. How do you decide what can stay and what has to go?
It can be very difficult. Yeah, the draft I sold was about a quarter again as long, which when is translated to manuscript pages was 980 manuscript pages and almost 300,000 words. And a lot of what I did to shrink it was less cutting big chunks of text or plot points or anything like that. It was more just small, pervasive trimming, you know, words, phrases, sentences. But it was so long that if you do that on every page, you really, you know, get rid of a lot of words. And I think it improved the sort of rhythm and momentum of the book quite a bit. But there were places where my editor, you know, I was pretty mindful throughout, I think, of not including my research just because I'd gone to the trouble of doing it. You know, that's always the danger with a heavily researched book. You're like, well, I looked this up, so it has to go in. And there are a couple places where my editor would write, you know, something like enough in the margin and be like, oh, okay, I think that's enough about the Alaskan landscape. But yeah, that's always a challenge.
You know, you took us through a number of decades and, you know, with the various plots and subplots. And one sentence that made me smile was in the more modern day time frame when Hadley hung up on her agent and you wrote, "This lacked gravitas on a smartphone, jabbing at the picture of a button." And yeah, this made me smile, but it also made me think about what it was like to write all of these different times and settings. And maybe this is more a question about craft, but it seemed like your sense of timing, like when we needed more Hadley or when we needed more of Jamie, it was impeccable. So did you work on the stories independently and then weave them together, or how is it mapped? Or, you know, can you share your flight plan with us for this book?
Sure. Well, thank you. I'm glad it read that way for you. The sort of balance between the two stories was one of the hardest things to sort of get to the place I wanted it to be and one of the last things to really fall into place. But I'm definitely a fly by the seat of my pants type writer. I find it impossible to outline in advance, partly because I get so many of my ideas as I go along. And in the case of this book, from the research, you know, I'd come across some detail that intrigued me and see a way to use it. And I'd think, oh, okay, you know, that's the direction I'll go now. Like, for example, Marion's brother, Jamie, is a artist during the war. And I think I just happened to come across a documentary about these artists who are all recruited by all the different branches of the military and just tasked with documenting what they saw and drawings and paintings and, you know, just total happenstance that I came across that. And so in it goes. So I wrote fairly chronologically through the book. So I did alternate between them as I went. And I think Hadley's sections, I had to take sort of a couple tries at. I had, you know, a version early on where she was like in a library looking up stuff about Marion, and that changed. But yeah, I kind of had to build it as I went, as opposed to sort of separating them out. And sometimes I would know when I wanted to change between the timelines just because of my own fatigue with what I was writing. And you sort of have that feeling of like, well, if I'm tired of this, the reader is probably ready for a little bit of a shift or a different sort of tone or accent at this moment too. So it's all fairly instinctive, but then definitely gets tweaked and reworked in edits.
I do have to say, and I'm not sure if this is related to editing or what, but something you included in your chapter heads had me never confused about where we were on a timeline. It was like you gave us our own logbook. It would include the location and the date and then a notation to help us with our bearings, something like 2 months before Jamie's mm-hmm. visit or 3 weeks later. Maybe I should ask about the intention of that detail.
Yeah. Oh, I'm so glad that worked for you. So that was my mom's idea. My first reader was my agent. So it took about 3 years and 3 months to write the first draft. And then I sent it to my agent, and there was like a month where she was reading it and sort of gathering her thoughts. And we talked at the end of that month, and my mom, you know, wanted to read it too. And she said, you know, maybe it would be helpful if you could do exactly what you're describing, not just give the date, the month and year, but say where this chapter is falling in relation to the previous action. And yeah, I thought it was a good idea. I'm glad you found it helpful.
Absolutely. You know, I want to talk a little bit about Marion and Jamie. They were twins, but mm-hmm. This line in the book, it made me pause, and I quote, "People thought being twins made them the same, but it was a balance, not sameness, she felt with him." There were also, you know, a few other lines that really spoke to me about the twins, and first from Marion, and I apologize, I'm just throwing your words back at you, but first from Marion, "If she could just go farther, live nowhere, possess only an airplane, and if that airplane never needed to land, then maybe she would feel free." And then later, in an internal monologue, she asked, "Why did she have this impulse to throw herself at boundaries, be flung back by them?" And then later, from Jamie, when he was actually in a plane, this quote, "The thought struck him that, up in the air, they were no different from planes that vanished. Only their eventual return distinguished them. Being aloft meant being lost to everyone but yourself." And he wondered if that appealed to Marion, or maybe she didn't notice anymore. So, like, for Marion, it was the sky. For Jamie, it was space. What do you think drew the twins to push these boundaries?
I mean, I think there's something possibly innate in certain people that draws them to this. And I think so, for those who haven't read the book, which is everyone right now, Mary and Jamie's father was a ship captain of an ocean liner. And there's sort of a disaster and he goes to prison and then he sort of vanishes. And so I think they spend their childhood sort of looking into this void of, you know, the world and how it can swallow a person and whether someone's alive or dead. And I think that probably maybe they have a bit of genetic predisposition to be seekers like their father was in his way. But also I think it's that, you know, formative experience of knowing something's out there, the answer to a question that you have, if only you could just go find it. And so I think that really shapes the adults they become. But I also just conceived of them, particularly Marian, as having kind of this innate drive toward toward freedom and movement.
You know, I sometimes scour an author's acknowledgments to glean a few questions. And in the preview copy I have, it simply says, allow 4 pages. And I have to tell you that this like piqued my curiosity so much. And it seems like authors who I read, they save their most important thank you for the last. So in the book, which will have the acknowledgments, I want to ask you, who did you thank last?
I thanked a man named Rodney who took me to Antarctica.
That was Maggie Shipstead, author of the novel Great Circle, which was published by Knopf. Thanks for joining us for Marginalia. If you enjoyed this podcast, please leave us a review. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita. Our engineers are Mark Statzer and Torin Anderson. Our editors are Luann Stevens and Haley Krausen, and I am the producer. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.